Physics World.
Hello, I'm Susan Curtis, the Managing Editor for Physics World Online, and welcome to this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. This week, I'm joined by Hamish Johnston, who's our General Physics Editor.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Hamish. And this week, we're going to be talking a lot about particle physics. And the reason for that is that this week, collider physicists from Europe and beyond will be meeting in Spain to discuss what the next big particle physics facility could be after the LHC. So, Hamish, what options are on the table?
Well, broadly speaking, there are two options. One is a circular collider that would be like the LHC, only much, much bigger in order to reach higher energies. If built in Europe, this could be along the lines of the FCC proposal. That's the Future Circular Collider. And that could be built at CERN. It would have a circumference that would be as big as 100 kilometers. Now, that's much bigger than the LHC, which has a circumference of 27 kilometers. And if you're familiar with the geography of Geneva, where the LHC is located, this much bigger collider, this FCC, would actually go under Lake Geneva. It would be absolutely massive. And this FCC would be capable of accelerating protons to about 100 TeV, and that's nearly 10 times the energy of the LHC, which is designed to reach 14 TeV.
So that would be a huge engineering challenge to build the FCC. And the second option, I understand, is a linear collider. Would that be any easier to build?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, one benefit of a linear collider is that it's a straight line. And so that means you can add to it. So you could build a linear collider, let's say with an energy of 1 TeV, and then if you didn't see what you wanted to see, you could just keep adding on to it, I suppose, as long as you have enough room where you're building it. A European candidate for a linear collider is called CLIC, the Compact Linear Collider. And this would be sort of tens of kilometers in length. Another possibility is the ILC, or International Linear Collider, and people would like to build that in Japan. That's sort of the candidate location for the ILC. Now, this is different than a circular collider, different than the LHC. The idea here is to collide electrons and positrons at energies up to several TeV, and so that's a much lower energy than the current LHC.
So what's the point of those much lower energies? What useful information could you get?
Well, that's a good question. And physicists argue that, they know that these positron-electron collisions would be much cleaner than the very messy proton-proton collisions that occur in the LHC and in a future FCC. And these clean collisions would allow for high-precision measurements on certain aspects of particle physics. And so these linear colliders are often described as Higgs factories. So the idea here is that you can make lots and lots of Higgs bosons, and you can make very careful measurements on them, and that could lead to a discovery of physics beyond the standard model. Whereas the LHC FCC model is much more, let's smash some protons together, create lots of stuff, and then we're going to have to search through that stuff in order to find something interesting. So there are two very different ways of looking for new physics. And of course, if we've got tons of money, we could build both. Let's see what happens.
So yeah, some big decisions there to make for the particle physics community. And Hamish, you were at a big particle physics meeting recently in April, where you were able to speak to a leading expert in collider design about the future for the field.
Yeah, I was at the April meeting of the American Physical Society, which is in Denver, Colorado. And when I was there, I spoke to Fermilab's Vladimir Shiltsev, who is at the meeting in Granada as we speak this week. And here's what he had to say about the process of selecting the world's next big particle collider.
So I'm Vladimir Shiltsev.
I'm a distinguished accelerator scientist, that is my title, at Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. And all my life in science, I worked on a large accelerator project and what we usually call super colliders. So these are energy frontier particle accelerators which collide particles, and you know, we always kind of try to deliver new breakthroughs in particle physics. And I worked on many of them, from super collider in Texas back in 1990s to Tesla linear collider in Germany in 1994-95. At some moment in 96, I moved to the United States, where we had Tevatron collider, and I was head of the Tevatron for several years. So when we kind of obtained really good results, kind of preceding LHC, we were very close to Higgs discovery, right? So I was head of the Tevatron at that time. And at some moment, we started to look into what's beyond that. So, and as I said, the facilities which particle physics operates, or kind of builds for the particle physics research, our community builds really big colliders. So planning for these colliders usually takes decades. Just planning, understanding design parameters, design needs, and so on and so forth. Then as soon as we understand, you know, what kind of facility we would like to build, we invest into the technological considerations. So how to reduce the actual cost of the facility, either cost of the tunnel or cost of the magnets or cost of the radio frequency accelerating cavities or something like that. Basically trying to optimize and come with a really thought through, balanced and cost optimized, performance optimized facility design. And when it's ready, we bring it to funding agencies as the community. We build the facility, which usually takes significant time, between usually like 5, 7 to 10, 11, 12 years, depending on the scale of the facility. And then these facilities are usually used for many decades. Take Tevatron, for example. It was a leading facility before the LHC. It operated as an energy frontier facility for 25 years, quarter of a century. Now LHC came in operation in 2008. Right now it has discovered, Higgs boson was discovered there, but people see additional like 15 years easily ahead of physics exploration at LHC, right? But having this nice machine right now doesn't guarantee that your future is secured. And given the scale of the projects, you need to invest in the future analysis, future discussion of strategy for the future right now, sooner the better, because you need to make some important decisions. So we would like to go, for example, with leptons, what we called, which are particles like electrons, positrons, anti-electrons, right, or hadrons, like protons, ions, or something else. Or you should focus on something really kind of people didn't try before, for example, muons, different type of lepton, which is super heavy electron, right? So there are a number of opportunities, and there are teams which are kind of developing these ideas. Some of them develop these ideas for years, right? And at some moment, these people should get together. And that's what we call, you know, strategy development plans. These plans, or these processes actually, strategy development processes, exist in all major regions, major players, like in the US, in Europe, in Asia, and there is actually so-called International Committee on Future Accelerators, ICFA, which tries to balance everything. So at the same time, we are friends. So the community is you know, is big, but still we know each other who does what. It's very international. So this year is the beginning of what we called European Particle Physics Strategy Update. That's not just a document. It's a whole process. And the process involves getting input from various teams, various proponents, sometimes from individuals even, right? And getting this input, so far like 131 proposals were submitted to that organization. Carefully considering all the options, waiting pros and contras, understanding risks and discussion. And particularly important discussion is, you know, say physics per buck cost. Cost-benefit analysis, right? So how much we can gain of insight in the most burning issues like dark matter, Higgs particles. So what will happen at the energies like 10 times the energy of the LHC and things like that. So there are many very important issues. So all those should be analyzed. And you see there are many aspects of the problem, from financial to technical to physics to understanding how relevant it is to answer questions about like from age of universe or what we call baryon asymmetry or non-existence of antimatter in the visible universe or dark matter, dark energy. So all goes into one box, so and for some months, so people discuss it, and every so often we get together. So as I told you, so next month in Granada, Spain, so there will be one of the most important meetings. But you know, representatives of all key proposals and say streams of thinking, so get together and discuss on equal footing, you know, all details and trying to shape possible recommendations to European funding agencies. So what kind of new physics we see decade or two ahead of us. And on basis of this recommendation, of course, hopefully they will be accepted. So, but the repercussions will be, you know, more focus on certain areas and probably less focus on other areas, right? So, and of course, meetings like that help the community to get together. So basically just make sure that nobody's forgotten, so that everyone had chance to speak up and present and be discussed, right? So, and of course, it's again, after that, of course, people will feel more comfortable with, you know, following kind of a joint consensus, right, of a kind. So, that's what we do. And as I said, the community is sort of used to it because we do that every 7 to 10 years. We do that in Europe. We did it many times in the US, and it worked really well. And actually helps us a lot if it's well organized and very clear, crisp, and recommendations are undubious. So then even funding agencies, you know, see the value in such recommendations, and of course they try to help us as much as possible within certain limits and so on and so forth. But still, seeing that community has made homework and the community comes prepared to answer the questions, it actually helps us a lot. Again, so we do some work on our part, and then later it will be transferred later to as I said, funding agency, governmental agencies, and so on and so forth. That's where we are.
So that was Fermilab's Vladimir Shiltsev talking about the process of selecting the world's next big collider project. So the meeting in Spain between collider physicists in Europe is concluding today. We don't know yet what their conclusions have been, but later on they should be releasing some information about what they've been discussing, and hopefully there'll be an update on Physics World later today for you to check out.
Yep, they're doing a press conference at 3 o'clock British summer time this afternoon, and I'll be listening to it. And hopefully there'll be some interesting tidbits about you know, whether the Swiss are going to start drilling a hole under Lake Geneva or not. I mean, I don't think things are going to progress that far, but it will be interesting to see what the outcome is. And, you know, hopefully it'll be a positive outcome for particle physics in Europe.
Well, we'll look forward to that. But of course, these big colliders aren't the only game in town when it comes to pushing our current understanding of particle physics. So Hamish, again, when you were in Colorado, you spoke to two neutrino physicists, I believe, who have explained why physicists are so interested in these ghostly particles.
Yes, when I was at the University of Colorado, I spoke to Alicia Marino and Eric Zimmerman. And they're two physicists who are involved in the T2K experiment in Japan. We had a wide-ranging discussion about neutrinos and how they fascinate physicists. And Alicia kicks off the discussion by explaining why what we can learn from neutrinos.
Hi, I'm Alicia Marino. I'm an associate professor of physics here at the University of Colorado Boulder. My research is in experimental neutrino physics, and I've been studying neutrinos in the lab for, I guess, a little over 20 years now. And so neutrinos are one of the fundamental building blocks of the universe. We're made of electrons and up and down quarks. We're not made of neutrinos, but they're still very numerous in nature. They're produced in large numbers in the Big Bang and also are produced in a lot of astrophysical processes. For example, there are about 100 billion neutrinos from the sun traveling through your thumbnail every second, day or night. And so there are a lot of them passing through us, or a lot of them in the room where we're sitting right now. But neutrinos are rather unusual compared to other particles in that they have no electric charge, and they also have no strong color charge, and so they only interact through something called the weak force, which indeed is very weak, and so that means that neutrinos can travel through enormous amounts of material almost completely undisturbed. So they do interact, but they interact fairly rarely. So in order to be able to study neutrinos in the lab, we need to have intense sources of neutrinos, and we also generally need to have pretty large detectors to have some hope of detecting their interactions. So it's taken people a long time to figure out things about neutrinos. For example, one of the things we're still a little bit unsure about is exactly what the mass of the neutrinos are. We can't hold them inside a box to do our experiments, and so for a long time people thought they had no masses. We knew that they were much lighter than particles like electrons, but we now have some evidence that at least some of the neutrinos have masses, and we presume that they all have some mass. So neutrinos come in three different flavors: electron, mu, and tau, and that's because when they're produced in a so-called charge current interaction, the neutrino is produced at the same time as a lepton of the same flavor. So electron neutrinos tend to be produced with electrons, et cetera. And so what we've been able to figure out over the past 20 years or so, or a little more than 20 years now, is we have pretty good evidence that neutrinos seem to be able to change from one kind to another. So if you produce a muon neutrino way up in the Earth's atmosphere, and you watch those neutrinos go through the Earth, some of those neutrinos seem to be changing into tau neutrinos and a little bit into electron neutrinos as well. And people also were looking for the neutrinos coming from the sun, which are only electron neutrinos produced in the fusion reactions deep in the core of the sun. And when we looked here on the Earth for electron neutrinos, we were only seeing about a third of what we expected. And we now know that's because they were changing to the other kinds of neutrinos, to mu and tau neutrinos. And for neutrinos to be able to change from one kind to another, it's really sort of a quantum mechanical interference. And it requires that the neutrinos have masses, and that the neutrino masses are different from one another. And also that the state, like the lightest mass neutrino, actually ends up being a mixture of electron, muon, and tau neutrinos. So we're trying to study how, if we take neutrinos from a known source and then try to look at them at some later distance and understand how they change from one kind to another, that can tell us a lot about the fundamental properties of the neutrino that we don't get from theory and have to go out and measure in the lab.
And so does that mean that the neutrino could provide a window into physics beyond the standard model?
So one of the things the standard model originally said was that neutrinos had to be massless. And so now we have pretty good evidence that neutrinos do seem to have, at least two of the neutrinos do seem to have non-zero mass. And that's something that we still need to figure out exactly how to put into the standard model of particle physics. The other thing that we also really want to understand is that neutrinos, like other particles, have antiparticles. So we have an anti-electron is like an electron but has positive charge instead. Neutrinos have their own antiparticles that are anti-neutrinos, and we really would like to try to understand, are neutrinos and anti-neutrinos, do they behave exactly the same way or not from each other? And that could have big consequences for the early universe.
So I'm Eric Zimmerman. I'm a professor in the physics department of the University of Colorado at Boulder. I also work on various neutrino physics experiments. So as Alicia said, the neutrino interacts only by the weak interaction, and that weak interaction is extremely weak. So interact doesn't just mean that's how it interacts, it means that's how you have to produce it as well. So that means there are actually relatively few processes that we can used to create neutrinos in very large numbers. And because they interact so weakly, if we're going to detect them, we need to produce them in very large numbers. To give you a sense of just how large, at T decay, one of our experiments that we do, of the neutrinos that are produced in our beam, something like 1 in 10 billion actually interacts and can be detected in our detector. Of the ones that pass through our detector, 1 in 10 billion actually interact. So we need a huge number to be created in order for us even to be able to observe a few interactions. So the kind of interactions that we can produce in very large quantities with particle accelerators, with nuclear reactors, even with radioactive sources, the kind of things that we can generally produce in very large numbers are strong interactions and, to a lesser extent, electromagnetic interactions. Now, the neutrinos are completely blind to these interactions, but it turns out that there are a fair number of particles that interact strongly, that we can produce strongly, but they are unstable and their decay is actually controlled by the weak interaction. So we have these particles that are produced strongly but then decay weakly. And those weak decays can actually produce neutrinos in numbers that are comparable to the number of strong interactions we produce. So we can produce particles called pions and kaons by the, you know, by the hundreds of billions in a particle accelerator using a proton beam that interacts with a target, in this case, a carbon target. It's actually, imagine a pencil lead the size of a baseball bat. That's basically what we're using. So a high-energy proton beam that comes from a particle accelerator interacts in this carbon target. It then produces many of these strongly interacting particles, like pions and kaons. A lot of these happen to have electric charge. The ones that are electrically charged, we can focus using magnetic fields. The magnetic fields focus the particles so that either positive particles are focused, negative particles are defocused, or the other way around, depending on what direction we run the magnets. Then these particles, once they're focused into a roughly parallel beam, we let them enter a long tunnel, usually called a decay region or a decay pipe or a decay tunnel. In the case of T-decay, the main experiment we're doing in Japan now, that tunnel is a little over 100 meters long. And while those particles are flying through this tunnel, many of them will spontaneously decay by the weak interaction, and they decay to the muon flavor neutrino. So we let these things decay in flight to the muon flavor neutrino. At the end of the tunnel is something we call a beam absorber. The beam absorber is basically just a very large block of material, and that block of material will absorb pretty much everything that isn't a neutrino. So you have the residual pions, kaons, protons, neutrons, photons, all kinds of things are hitting this block of material, including the neutrinos. Everything gets absorbed except the neutrinos. The neutrinos can keep flying through the Earth with no, you know, with essentially no interactions, nothing to stop it, because all they see is the weak interaction. Then at the far end of our beam actually goes through the Earth, in the case of T-decay, about 300 kilometers, where it goes through a large water tank called Super Kamiokande on the west side of Japan. And that's what we use to detect our neutrinos. So we know that most of our neutrinos, when they're produced, are muon neutrinos, and we're looking to see by the time they reach Super Kamiokande, 300 kilometers away, how many of them have turned into electron neutrinos. And Super Kamiokande is actually a detector that's got a lot of history. It was first operated in 1996, and within 2 years, it made the first discovery of neutrino oscillations, which in turn was the first extremely firm evidence we have that neutrinos are massive. And that was done using naturally produced neutrinos in cosmic rays. So cosmic rays interact in the atmosphere, and pretty much the same thing happens when the cosmic rays interact in the upper atmosphere as happens when our particle accelerator beam hits our carbon target. The protons from cosmic rays produce pions and kaons. They travel through the atmosphere, and then some of them decay in flight to neutrinos. So Super Kamiokande, as I said, is a large water detector. It's a tank of ultra-pure water, about 50,000 tons of ultra-pure water, and it sits underneath a mountaintop in an abandoned zinc mine in western Japan. And when a neutrino interacts with an oxygen nucleus, if it's a muon neutrino, it will produce a charged particle called a muon. If it's an electron neutrino, it'll produce a charged particle called an electron. Generally, all types of neutrino detection devices will use these particles that the neutrinos produce when they interact. You can't see the neutrino itself. All you can see is the interaction products. So you're looking for a kind of event happening in your detector where you see nothing come in, and then spontaneously charged particles are produced in the detector. And that's what we detect. The detection method varies depending on the type of detector technology. In the case of Super Kamiokande, it's what's called Cherenkov radiation, which is what happens when a charged particle is moving faster than the speed of light in a material. So when light goes through water, it travels about one-third slower than it does when light travels through a vacuum. Of course, the particle can never travel faster than the speed of light in vacuum, just from relativity, but it can certainly travel faster than the speed of light in water. And when it does, a very distinctive cone-shaped pattern of radiation is produced. It's a pattern of light that's somewhat similar to a sonic boom is when an object goes faster than the speed of sound. So you get a cone-shaped pattern of light that is detected on the wall of this, when it reaches the wall of this detector, where there are, I believe, about 11,000 20-inch photomultiplier tubes that are able to detect single photons with about a one-third efficiency. So we look at the details of the pattern of light on the wall, and we can decide whether the particle that was produced was a muon or an electron. So we started, as I said, with a primarily muon neutrino beam. There's actually what's called a near detector on the lab site by the particle accelerator that will allow us to look at the neutrino beam with somewhat different technology, but will allow us to look at the types of neutrinos in the beam and the energy distribution of the neutrinos in the beam before it makes the long trip to Super Kamiokande. Then at Super Kamiokande, we see if there are more electron neutrinos and fewer muon neutrinos than we started with. T2K, about 5 years ago now, discovered this new Mu-to-Nu-E oscillation, which hadn't been observed before, and also sees a very large effect where the muon neutrinos appear to disappear. So we start with far more muon neutrinos than we end up with at the far detector. And we also have a lot more electron neutrinos than we had at the far detector.
Those experiments sound really fascinating, Hamish. Did Alicia and Eric talk about any more recent results?
Well, they did hint off the record that they are about to, I think, publish some new results. But Alicia also spoke about measurements that they've done recently about CP violation. And this is related to a profound mystery in the universe. And that is, why is there much more matter than antimatter in the universe? So here's Alicia talking about that experiment.
So one of the big things that we're interested in trying to make really precise measurements of these neutrino oscillations is also to try to study the oscillations of antineutrinos. And as Eric said, when you have we make the neutrino beam, we're usually focusing positively charged particles that decay to neutrinos, and you can instead reverse the direction of the current and focus negatively charged particles, and then you get an antineutrino, primarily antineutrino beam instead. And so what we're trying to do in T2K is we're producing muon neutrinos or muon antineutrinos, and then looking, if we look at the appearance of electron neutrinos or electron antineutrinos in Super Kamiokande, we want to see if those are happening at the same rate or not. And what we seem to be seeing early hints of so far in T2K is that we do seem to see a difference between them. It's not at the 99% confidence level yet, but we do see hints that the muon neutrinos seem to turn into electron neutrinos at a higher rate than muon antineutrinos turn into electron antineutrinos in the detector. And so that's potentially exciting because the universe that we live in now seems to be matter-dominated, and we assume that there are roughly equal amounts of matter and antimatter, and so there has to be something to break that symmetry between matter and antimatter. And so we've seen that quarks do this to some degree, but it hasn't yet been seen in leptons like electrons or neutrinos, and so this is another place that could possibly explain this matter-antimatter asymmetry that we have in the universe now. And so at least, again, the early hints from T2K is that we do see this difference, but we were trying to make more precise measurements of this, and there are also other experiments that are trying to measure this now as well, and it'll be something that people will be looking at a lot over the next decade with neutrino oscillation experiments.
Neutrinos can also tell us something about astrophysical objects, can't they? I mean, you can do astronomy with neutrinos to a certain extent.
Yeah, so in the early history of neutrino experiments, one of the first things that people tried to do after the neutrino was detected was to look for the neutrinos that are produced in the core of the sun. Again, they're produced in enormous numbers in the fusion reactions in the solar core, and so people sought out to measure them and kept seeing fewer than expected. And so even though we started off trying to use neutrinos to to learn about the universe and to do astrophysics, in the end it was kind of a surprise. We learned something unexpected about the neutrino instead. But now, as we start to understand the neutrino properties, it is possible to try to go back now and use neutrinos to probe astrophysical phenomena as well. And neutrinos, again, they're very difficult to detect because they interact so weakly. But on the other hand, that can be a real bonus if you're trying to study really distant phenomena occurring in the universe. And so, supernovas give off enormous amounts of neutrinos. And so if we could detect these neutrinos from supernovas have been detected in the past, but if we were lucky enough to have another supernova occur in the galaxy in the next decade or so, we'd be able to detect those neutrinos and could potentially start to understand more about the processes occurring in a core collapse supernova. And also, increasingly, people are using neutrinos to study, more distant but highly energetic phenomena. Neutrinos, unlike photons or other particles, other charged particles, which get bent by magnetic fields and photons get absorbed. The nice thing about neutrinos is that they more or less travel in a straight line from the source. And so that makes them an interesting probe of very distant energetic astrophysical phenomena. And with the Ice Cube experiment located at the South Pole, which has now started to detect very high energy astrophysical neutrinos, we're sort of entering into an era now where we're going back to actually trying to use neutrinos to go back and use them to probe the galaxy. Although, again, we still, in labs, are still trying to understand as much as we can about the neutrinos as well.
Because I thought it was interesting. I think it was last year when the LIGO neutron star merger results happened. People were looking for a neutrino signal, but there was no neutrino signal as far as I could tell. But I suppose it's just another flavor in multi-messenger astronomy, isn't it? That could tell us quite a bit about astrophysical objects.
Right, so combining what you could see, both in photons or in gravity waves, along with what you see in neutrinos, again, is a nice way to probe lots of really distant energetic astrophysical phenomena. So it's another, tool that we have in our toolkit to try to probe the universe. Again, still a very difficult one to detect.
I remember reading, a few years ago where someone made the claim that neutrinos are the unsung heroes of particle physics, that, we really do get a lot of information from neutrinos, but they're, for some reason, they're not as sexy, I don't know, as the Higgs boson, for example. But, obviously, you two really enjoy working in neutrinos. And what do you find the most fascinating about neutrinos?
To me, neutrinos are something that we certainly have started to understand a lot better in the last 20 years, but almost all throughout the history of the neutrino, there have been a lot of surprises. They are very different from all of the other particles that we know about, and so I think the thing that excites me is hoping that maybe we'll find, yet another, unexpected discovery about neutrinos, because, again, they are just so fundamentally different from all the other particles we know about.
I guess I'd say not only are neutrinos fundamentally different from all the other particles we know about, they're also, in some sense, more fundamental than the other particles we know about. The proton, the pion, the kaon, the neutron, all of these things are actually composite objects. They have a lot of very complicated internal dynamics. But the neutrino, very similar in some ways to the electron and the muon and the tau, is a fundamental particle that sits out on its own. And unlike the E, mu, and tau, the neutrino only sees the weak interaction, which makes it a really precise probe of that interaction. There's nothing else to distract you, really, in neutrino physics. So you can really understand things at a very deep and precise level using neutrinos that you can't really do with the strongly interacting particles.
Well, that's great. Thanks, Alicia, and thanks, Eric.
Well, that was a really interesting discussion with Alicia Marino and Eric Zimmerman. What do you think would be really interesting for the next stage of neutrino physics?
What I would really like to see is neutrinos detected at the same time as gravitational waves, sort of a multi-messenger astronomy use of neutrinos. And, wouldn't it be fantastic if there was a supernova or another sort of event that produced electromagnetic radiation, gravitational waves, and neutrinos, and they were all detected at once by astronomers. You know, just think of what we could learn from that. You know, that's something that's definitely on my checklist. And, you know, who knows? LIGO and Virgo, the gravitational wave detectors, are really, really doing a great job at the moment. So maybe we will see a simultaneous detection of gravitational waves and neutrinos. That's definitely something to look out for.
That would definitely be really exciting, wouldn't it? Mm. So yeah, let's hope that that comes in the near future.
Physics World.
But of course, Physics World isn't just particle physics. And Susan, you're leading an initiative on Physics World to celebrate the International Year of the Periodic Table. So what's that all about? I understand that Physics World editors are going to be picking their favorites.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So as you're aware, it's the International Year of the Periodic Table this year, celebrating 150 years since Dmitry Mendeleev first published his first version of a periodic table. And what we thought we would do to mark the anniversary would be for, as you say, for Physics World editors to pick out the elements that they think are maybe not exactly their favourite, but it could be the elements that they think are most important for science and technology. So we've got a series of these articles going up over the next month or so. So each of the editors have picked one element. We're going to be calling the series Battle of the Elements, not that they're going to be doing battle properly, but because we want the editors really to put forward an argument to say why they think that this particular element has been so important or pivotal for science and technology. So look out for that. The first one will be going up today. It will be on the site on Thursday, and then we'll be publishing further ones over the next few weeks.
I think I'm up second, aren't I?
You're second,
so I'm not
that's
up today,
right.
But
yeah.
So tune in to find out what my favourite element is.
Yeah, but we're not going to put out any spoilers as to what the elements have been chosen, but we'd really encourage listeners to get involved. They can go to our Twitter feed, follow our hashtag, and suggest what element that they would choose and why.
And now looking at what else is on the website this week, Susan, you've got a news story from the environment section.
So the first thing we wanted to talk about is news that the weather extremes that we've all been experiencing in recent summers have been linked by researchers to large-scale atmospheric waves, which are known as Rossby waves, that can become stalled in the jet stream. Here in the UK, we're well aware that the jet stream in the Northern Hemisphere travels westwards about 10 kilometres above the Earth's surface, and it generally travels at the same latitude. But jet stream winds can also meander from north to south and back again, and then they form a wave-like pattern, which are called Rossby waves. Now, these Rossby waves normally continue to move from east to west, but they can also become stalled, which can lead to heat waves, droughts, and floods, as the regions of hot and cold air hover over the same regions for days or even weeks. Now, climate researchers from the UK, Germany, and the Netherlands have shown that extreme weather events in 2018, which included heat waves in North America and across much of Europe, as well as heavy rain and flooding in Japan, were linked by a stalled pattern of seven peaks and troughs in the jet stream. They also point out that this wave seven pattern was also present during extreme weather events in the summers of 2003, 2006, and 2015, and that the number of these wave seven events has increased significantly over the last 20 years. You can find out more about this story in Summer Weather Extremes Linked to Stalled Rossby Waves in the Jet Stream. Over to you, Hamish, for something from the materials world.
Yeah, this is a story about machine learning. And I mean, I have to say, we've been covering machine learning as it's applied to physics and other fields quite often on Physics World. I mean, it's incredible how machine learning has become a hot topic across the sciences. This is a story about researchers in Australia who have shown that dimension reduction algorithms that are used in bioinformatics, finance, transport, and social sciences can also help material sciences to visualize data and help to identify patterns in the relationships between the structure and function of materials. This is a new thing because these algorithms had sort of passed by materials scientists in the past because they were not developed with the properties of materials in mind. You can read more in Machine Learning Puts Nanomaterials in the Picture by our materials expert Anna Deming. And Susan, I think you've got something from the world of medical physics next.
That's right, I do. And in this new work, US researchers have developed a new technique that they can use to determine the metabolic activity of individual cancer cells per hour. And the great thing about this new technique is that they can analyze thousands of cancer cells really quickly. And it provides really important information to oncologists who might be planning treatments for cancer therapy. The really useful thing about it is that knowing the rate at which cells consume oxygen is important not only just for distinguishing between healthy cells and cancer cells, but also for understanding any variations in cellular behaviour across a tumour. So in this new work, scientists from Caltech and from Texas A&M University use photoacoustic spectroscopy, in which laser pulses generate an ultrasound signal upon absorption by specific molecules. And they use this technique to measure the levels of oxygenated and deoxygenated hemoglobin in individual cells that were placed in microwells. Now, as I said before, the technique offers a much higher throughput than existing techniques, and so it could give clinicians a much more complete picture of any heterogeneity that exists in a tumour, and ultimately could lead to much more accurate diagnoses and more effective treatment. And all the details on that are in the story, Photoacoustic Microscopy Captures Variation Within Tumours. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. For more news, in-depth articles and opinion, check out the Physics World website, and you'll find more Physics World podcasts there, and also from your favourite podcast provider, including iTunes and now Spotify. See you next week.
Physics World.